The last investigator I chatted with was Dr. Fabrice Andre, who was the discussant of one of the most interesting ever San Antonio poster sessions a couple of years ago. That afternoon in December 2009 focused on gene expression profiling and the first results of a retrospective prospective dataset on Oncotype DX in patients with node-positive tumors. Dr. Andre began our discussion by providing an overview of the potential for genomic prediction in breast cancer.
So for gene expression profiling, I think we have four different needs for genomic prediction. We have the first need that has been the one developed in the last 5-10 years that consists of developing gene expression signature or multiplex genomic assay to identify the patient who don't need chemotherapy. So this is the illustration of the recurrence score or the 70 gene signature from Amsterdam. This is
a mammoprint.
Yeah, this is one, what we call first generation signature. We want to identify the patient who do not need adjuvant chemotherapy. Then currently we are moving to several other kind of genomic predictor. The first genomic predictor that from my point of view is really, really important is a genomic predictor who could identify the patient who will relapse, although treated with optimal conventional treatment, including chemotherapy. That is radically different to the first scenario. In that case, we want to have to identify within all the patients that we are treating now, which are the ones who need new treatment. And this is very important because this will allow us developing adjuvant trials with a fewer number of patients. And also, very importantly, to propose these new drugs only to a few subset of patients who are the ones who really need new treatment. This is the topic of the presentation we had with Fraser Simmons. What they are doing, they have developed a genomic predictor who identifies the patient will present a pathologic complete response, but who have a very high probability of developing a pathologic complete response. And then they look at whether this predictor has a prognostic value in patients treated with fake or anthracycline-based chemotherapy plus taxane-based chemotherapy plus endocrine therapy for patients who have estrogen receptor-positive disease. And what they have shown is that indeed, when you apply this predictor, you can identify a population of patients who is at very high risk of relapse, although they have been treated with optimal treatment. So this is really, from my point of view, this is really important advance in the field of genomic prediction. And now we are moving forward by doing some validation studies with a high number of patients treated with anthracycline, taxane, and endocrine therapy in the adjuvant setting. So that is one of the genomic predictor. And then we have two other set of genomic predictor. We have the genomic predictors to develop toxicity. I will not develop on that. And we have genomic predictors that aim at identifying the key target in the metastatic setting. So for example, this is one of the presentation we did where we are screening the patient for a specific genomic alteration. And then we include the patient in a biology-driven phase 2 trial, and in that case, it was FGFR1 inhibitor. So we have these four different sets of genomic predictors. And for me, the two most important now are the one who can identify the patient who will relapse whatever we do, and the one that will allow us to identify the target in patients with metastatic disease.
In terms of that initial purpose of prediction, being able to avoid chemotherapy, you did the commentary. I was at the poster discussion at San Antonio. I think it was the San Antonio before last when the Albane SWOG node positive data for Oncotype was presented. And first of all, I have to congratulate you all because I was incredible how you got the paper and your editorial of the paper published simultaneously, and that was at Lancet Oncology?
Yeah.
That was really awesome to be able to pull that off. Can you talk a little bit about what your thoughts were at that time when you saw those data and what your thoughts are right now?
There are two pieces of answer. First, I think that we have now enough evidence to consider that in patients with estrogen receptor positive disease, node negative disease, recurrent score can identify a group of patients who do not derive a high benefit of adjuvant chemotherapy. We have at least 6 different studies from randomized trials. It's pretty clear. The picture is less clear in node-positive disease. What the study by Cathy Alban showed is that patients with low recurrent score do not derive high benefit from anthracycline-based chemotherapy. Still, there are a lot of pitfalls in node-positive disease. The first one is the fact that, to my knowledge, nobody has shown the predictive value of recurrent score for a taxane. The second pitfall is that in node-positive disease, the studies and the amount of evidence is very low for recurrent score, and we need more evidence. So I think that there are two quite major pitfalls, from my point of view, for using the recurrent score in the context of node-positive disease. But I am aware that some clinical trials are going to start now to address specifically the question of the value of the recurrent score in node-positive disease. And these trials will be very important, especially to make the difference between the prediction to adjuvant chemo and the prognostic value of recurrent score.
It's interesting that you bring up the taxane issue. I don't recall anybody mentioning that before, but I mean, that would theoretically be relevant to the node-negative population too.
Yeah, except that from my point of view, the recurrent score has a so strong prognostic value in node-negative disease that you don't need to add chemotherapy to this patient. Then the fact that the test is also predictive for first or second generation chemotherapy is something that is reassuring. But in fact, we didn't need that because when the patient has low recurrent score, the rate of metastasis is always below 10% at 10 years. So basically, we did not need to have the prediction for adjuvant chemo to use the test in node-negative disease because it's so prognostic when the patient are treated with endocrine therapy. For node-positive, it's really a different issue.
You mentioned the 70-gene assay, the MammaPrint. What are your thoughts about that assay in terms of the data that's available and whether or not it's of practical clinical utility?
So I think for the 70-gene assay, the picture is a little bit different from my point of view. First, the evidence are not based on a retrospective analysis of randomized trial. That is one of the pitfalls of the development of these specific biomarkers. Second, the processing of the sample is a little bit different, and we still need a frozen sample, at least in Europe. The point number three that is very good for the MammaPrint is that there is a huge randomized trial that is going to finish soon in Europe that will specifically address the question of whether the use of MammaPrint can decrease the indication of chemotherapy with the same long-term outcome.
So it's the MINDEC trial?
MINDEC trial, 6,000 patients, and the recruitment is going very fast, and probably the trial will be finished quite soon. This is really important point. And then with this trial, we will get a key answer for this question.
Any comments on the recent data that's come out on mTOR inhibitors in breast cancer?
I think this is probably the most exciting development now in breast cancer, is the capacity of mTOR inhibitor to potentially reverse the resistance to endocrine therapy. This is based on two different trials. So the first trial was a neoadjuvant study, letrozole plus or minus everolimus, that showed an increasing sensitivity in the everolimus arm based on Ki-67. So this is a paper published by Baselga. The second very interesting study was also phase 2 randomized trial in patients resistant or pretreated with aromatase inhibitor. The phase 2 randomized trial compared tamoxifen to tamoxifen plus everolimus presented in San Antonio. And in this trial, there is a high benefit in the everolimus arm. And now there is a phase 3 registration trial whose name is Bolero 2, who will answer the question about whether everolimus provides some benefit in patients previously treated with aromatase inhibitors.
So let's talk a little bit about HER2-positive disease. And if I could, I'd like to begin by actually asking you about a case that a physician in practice just emailed me about, Dr. Isaac Levy from Hollywood, Florida. Pretty common conundrum that physicians face. The patient is a 69-year-old woman with a right mastectomy, moderately differentiated, ERPR positive, HER2 positive / IHC 3+. It was a 4-millimeter node negative lesion. And of course, you know what's coming, which is, what does he do? One other fact, and I don't know whether this is relevant or not, I'm curious what you think about, is the Ki-67 was 15%.
So here are two different comments. The first question is about the use of systemic treatment in HER2 overexpressing breast cancer below 1 centimeter. That is the first topic. Second topic is use of Ki-67 in HER2 overexpressing breast cancer. So for the first topic...
Or anybody with breast cancer.
So the first question, in our practice, usually when the tumor is below 1 centimeter, we are doing HER2 plus chemo only in patient with a tumor above 5 millimeter. So in this specific patient, I would not have recommended the use of trastuzumab plus chemotherapy. But we would have done endocrine therapy, of course, as adjuvant treatment. So in this specific patient, I would not have done chemo plus trastuzumab. One of the problems we are facing now is the fact that in all trials, adjuvant trials testing trastuzumab, trastuzumab was given either concomitantly or sequentially to chemotherapy. So because of that, we cannot propose, at least we do not propose in my center, adjuvant trastuzumab alone or in combination with endocrine therapy without chemotherapy. So in this specific patient, endocrine therapy, aromatase inhibitor, but I would not have done chemo plus trastuzumab.
You hear a lot that 5 millimeter kind of arbitrary or selected value. Does your inclination for or against chemo change whether the patient's ER positive or not?
No, I think I try to keep this 5 millimeter limit, although I agree with everybody that this is not based on evidence. But we could reverse the argument saying that finally doing chemo plus trastuzumab between 5 millimeter and 1 centimeter is not really based on evidence neither. It's just based on retrospective studies, no randomized trial. So we cannot quantify the benefit of this drug between 5 millimeter and 1 centimeter. So I would not go below 5 millimeters, although I agree that this is not based on evidence. I think there is really a need for clinical trial in this setting between 0 and 10 millimeter. It's really a medical need addressing the benefit of systemic treatment in this patient.
And you've been involved in the development of T-DM1, and I want to ask you about that. But I also kind of wonder if, you know, we were 5 years down the line and knew that T-DM1 was equal to chemo trastuzumab, whether that might be more attractive for a patient like this.
I think for me, T-DM1 is two revolutions. The first is the proof of concept that when you combine on the same drug, cytotoxic agent plus antibody as a vector, then you get a high level of efficacy. That is really proof of concept. And this proof of concept is being done with HER2, but I am pretty sure that there will be a lot of development with other receptors. So this is proof of concept. It's really nice.
Yeah, I mean, actually, just in the last 6 months, we've seen brentuximab vedotin in anaplastic large cell lymphoma, you know, similar kind of concept using anti-CD30, Hodgkin's disease also. Can you talk about where we are right now with T-DM1 and where you think it's heading?
I think for me, the second revolution for T-DM1 is the fact that it's going to address the question of decreasing toxicity. So it's really a new era in the field of breast cancer treatment. This means that for a specific subset of the disease, we are moving from the question of adding efficacy to the question of decreasing toxicity. Then the question is, what is going to happen in this field? I think that one important question to solve in the next year is going to be whether doing trastuzumab plus chemotherapy is more toxic and maybe is more costly than doing T-DM1 alone. That is going to be the next very important question. If the oncology community can show that T-DM1 is less toxic but as effective as chemo plus trastuzumab, then I think we will really enter in a new era of adjuvant treatment for breast cancer.
I mean, would you feel differently if T-DM1 were available for this patient at 4 millimeters, or still you think the risk is too low?
For me, I think the overall how I grew up in the field is that because the disease is so frequent, we really need to stick to evidence from a randomized trial. So this means that if in the clinical trial we have patient between 0 and 10 millimeter, I will do TDM1 if I get the reimbursement. If not, I will follow what other guidelines from scientific societies are, but I think maybe TDM1 will get some approval in this population below 10 millimeter, but if these patients are included in clinical trials. If not, I don't see how we can go to reimbursement and development.
You were alluding to the fact that we don't have data right now on trastuzumab without chemotherapy. I'm not sure we ever will get it, although I know in the clinical trials session here, they're talking about a trial looking at trastuzumab alone. Do you have any sense about what would be seen if trastuzumab were compared to trastuzumab chemo?
Trastuzumab versus trastuzumab chemo.
As adjuvant therapy.
Adjuvant chemotherapy in patients with HER2 overexpressing breast cancer has been shown in several studies to be highly effective. So I don't think that trastuzumab alone would be better than chemotherapy. I think that it would be even lower than chemotherapy. And the question for me is more trastuzumab plus endocrine therapy versus endocrine therapy. And in this specific situation, I think indeed that we would have some efficacy based on the two clinical trials that have been done in the metastatic setting. We have two different trials, one with lapatinib, one with trastuzumab. Both of the trials show that there is a hazard ratio around 0.5 to 0.7, suggesting that if this drug is moving to adjuvant setting, we will get some level of efficacy. But some could argue that in several adjuvant trials, when we use only 1 year trastuzumab sequentially after adjuvant chemotherapy, then the level of efficacy of trastuzumab is not so high. So for me, the question about combining trastuzumab to endocrine therapy is really a question of duration. And in that setting, I'm not sure that 1 year is enough.
There is a trial out there looking at 2 versus 1. Any idea when that might be reported?
I don't have any idea, but overall, I think there are 4 trials addressing the question of duration. For me, the key point now is really whether the trastuzumab is combined or not with cytotoxic agent, more than the question of duration, I think.
I think your point is well taken. I guess I probably should have reworded that a little bit differently. I think where people are thinking about trastuzumab monotherapy is the patient who's not a candidate for chemo because they're too old or they're sick, et cetera. And, you know, you made a really interesting point there about whether or not trastuzumab would add to hormone therapy. Do you think trastuzumab would be better than nothing if the patient were ER negative, HER2 positive?
I think ER negative, HER2 positive, from my point of view, I would really go to cytotoxic agent plus trastuzumab. The problem is that cytotoxic agent had bad press in the last years. But finally, in my practice, doing a short adjuvant treatment with weekly paclitaxel is not usually toxic and can synergize a lot with trastuzumab. So if we tell that there is a need to provide systemic treatment to decrease the rate of metastasis, if we are in the setting of ER-negative disease, personally, in very small tumor, maybe I would prefer having weekly paclitaxel plus trastuzumab versus the current standard of care, that is no treatment when it's below 5 millimeters or something like this.
You know, it's really interesting when you talk about using clinical evidence, because the paclitaxel trastuzumab that's being tested by Dana-Farber has now been almost completely universally accepted by investigators in their clinical practice. We did a program last night with 8 investigators, including Eric and a number of prominent people, presented an 85-year-old patient and paclitaxel trastuzumab, but I'm not sure I've seen any evidence on it. Have you?
No. There are some trials in the metastatic setting with weekly paclitaxel, but in fact, it's so convenient that, and I think we need to know how to use the evidence. So meaning that sometime when we have accumulating evidence that a drug is less toxic and is in the same family of a drug that is by far more toxic, and these two drugs have similar efficacy, then we need to know how to better use the non-toxic drug and how to better integrate this drug in the adjuvant setting. But still, you know, for the question about the development of trastuzumab plus endocrine therapy alone in the adjuvant setting. I think that there are some populations for which there is clearly only a few clinical research activity, that are the elderly patient or patient with comorbidities. We have a lot of number of these patients for which we are really scared about doing chemotherapy. And these patients have ER-positive, HER2-overexpressing breast cancer. So I think that clinical research is really important in patients with comorbidities. First, because they deserve clinical research. And second, because we can learn a lot from clinical research done in this patient population.
I'm curious about your thoughts about some of the new strategies that are coming out in HER2-positive disease. There was a pretty interesting session with three European neoadjuvant trials that was presented at the San Antonio meeting. One of them, the NeoSphere study, included a new agent, pertuzumab, that I like your take on. And another, the so-called NeoAlto study, look at the combination of lapatinib and trastuzumab with chemo. What are your thoughts about those data?
So overall, these data show that in the neoadjuvant setting, when we have a dual blockade, there is an increase in the rate of pathologic complete response. So in terms of proof of concept, this means that targeting the same receptor but on different part could increase the efficacy of trastuzumab. So that is what it's teaching us in terms of proof of concept. There are a lot of unknowns for this. First unknown is to what extent the improvement in PCR rate will translate into improvement in clinical endpoint, DFS, overall survival, etc. So this is one unknown. And this will be answered by several trials that are being done in the adjuvant setting, including the ALTO trial that tested trastuzumab versus trastuzumab lapatinib versus lapatinib. The second unknown is really to know which patient do not need this drug, because in our practice, most of the patients with trastuzumab, they are already cured with chemotherapy plus trastuzumab. So here, as we discussed before for genomic predictors, we really need to know which patient do not need additional treatment than chemo plus trastuzumab. Because otherwise, we are developing drugs, new drugs in patients who are already cured. That does not make sense in terms of medicine. Finally, the last question is going to be how to integrate these new drugs all together in the daily practice. And here, the future landscape for me is really not clear at that time, because we have two different drugs family developed in the neoadjuvant adjuvant setting. We are the first family that aim at decreasing toxicity. It's, for example, T-DM1, we discussed before, although this drug can also increase efficacy. And we have a set of drugs that are being developed to increase the efficacy of trastuzumab. So here we have two different drug families. And from my point of view, I don't know how they will be integrated in the daily practice in the next 10 years from now. What I think is that I hope that one team will come with genomic predictors to predict relapse in patients with HER2 treated with trastuzumab. And then we have the patient cured. And in this patient, we'll test the hypothesis of toxicity with T-DM1. And in patient predicted not to be cured, then we will test the hypothesis of efficacy with adding lapatinib, adding pertuzumab, or doing T-DM1. And then we have the question of what to do at the relapse, because a few number of patients will relapse or will present with a stage 4 disease at diagnosis. For this patient, of course, we can use the targeted agent that was not used at the time of neoadjuvant adjuvant treatment. And we have a new set of agents that are being developed in the HER2 setting, like everolimus, or HSP90 inhibitor, or PI3 kinase inhibitor. And these drugs, I think they really have some important position in the metastatic setting. So I would say T-DM1 for patients already cured, decreased toxicity, lapatinib and pertuzumab to increase efficacy, and then in the metastatic setting, all these new drugs like inhibitors of transduction signal, etc. So it's three different scenarios.
Where does pertuzumab fit in?
I think pertuzumab will be developed in the patient who will relapse although treated with trastuzumab. Because now from the neoadjuvant setting, we have some clear evidence that adding pertuzumab to trastuzumab is improving the rate of pathologic complete response. So this drug, from my point of view, needs to be developed with the aim of increasing efficacy. So this means that this drug needs to be developed in the setting of patients who are predicted to relapse, although treated with trastuzumab. So there are really three different aims, three different populations, and three different positions for the drugs.